is 18-4039, United States versus Goulet. How do you say that?
Goulet, Your Honor.
See, Mr. Tenney, you may proceed.
I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Ryan Tenney on behalf of the United States. Subject to questions or direction from the Court, I'd like to begin with the two issues that were raised below. First, I'll address the detention issue. Second, I'll address the frisk issue. On the detention issue, it is settled in this circuit that when officers pull a car over, they can detain any passengers inside the car, that's Holt, for the duration of the stop. That's Arizona versus Johnson. The detention issue here essentially raises two new questions about the scope of that authority. First, whether the officers can also detain the passengers outside the car for the duration of a car search. And second, if that's true, whether they retain that authority if the search is based on consent as opposed to probable cause.
Is that an open question in this circuit?
We think it's dictated by current precedent, but it's certainly something the defendant has contested. So I'm happy to address it if you have any concerns about it. We think it's a natural extension of Mims and Wilson and Johnson. I mean, what those cases, that whole sequence of cases establish is that the officer's safety concern allows them to detain not just the driver, but also the passengers. Wilson says you can order them out of the car. Johnson says you can frisk them. They don't have to be the suspect or the driver. They just have to be involved. And once they're involved in some way, once they're stopped, the officers, if they have reason to detain them, or if their officer safety concerns allow them to detain them. And that seems to be the point.
First of all, do they need reasons to detain them? And do they need a reason, or can they, just as a matter of practice, require passengers to stay nearby?
I think that's the sliver of this that perhaps is unanswered. But here's what I think the answer is. Wilson looks at the question of whether officers can order passengers out of the car. And there's a footnote at the end of Wilson that says that the Supreme Court has essentially created a categorical rule that they can. So we know from Mims and Wilson that they can order both drivers and passengers categorically out of the car. So then the question is, well, once they get out of the car, can they continue to detain them? I'm not aware of any case that says categorically they can, but it seems really consistent with the cases that do exist that they can. Because you look at that Fourth Amendment balancing, where you're comparing the intrusion to the officer safety concern, and you've got that language from Brindlin and Johnson that talks about the need or the ability to exercise unquestioned command of the situation. It would be really anomalous from a Fourth Amendment perspective to say that the officers have the authority to detain them inside the car for the duration, Holt. They have the categorical authority to order them out of the car, Wilson. But that once they let them out of the car, they then have to let them go.
And then how long before they have to let them go under your theory of the case?
Johnson answers that question. Johnson says that they can detain them for the duration of the stop, and it then defines duration of the stop as, quote, when the police have no further need to control the scene. As long as they have valid justification to search, they still have a need to control the scene. And so in our view,
in this case also we don't have a licensed driver.
Right.
Does that extend the scope or the length of the detention?
It does, for independent reasons, right. I mean, whether it's based on a search or whether it's based on an ongoing investigation, Johnson's overarching umbrella rule is as long as officers have a need to control the scene, they can control the scene. And the reason is to protect themselves. So as long as they're searching the car validly, whether it's based on consent or probable cause or what have you, they have the ability to protect themselves, and if that means detaining the passengers and telling them where to go or where to sit, that's what they can do.
Could they have just directed them to leave the scene, to go over to the gas station, go inside?
In theory, they could have
chosen. Get a soda?
Yeah. In theory, they could have chosen that. And that would fall under officer discretion about how best to control the scene. But if the officers believe that the best way to protect themselves for the duration of the stop is to tell you to sit here, then they can do that. That's the answer. Okay. If there are any questions at all about the detention, I'd be happy to field those questions. If not, I'll move to the frisk issue. There's always a danger as an appellate prosecutor of creating something of a hierarchy of factors.
Before you turn that, Mr. Goulet does make a point that the detention was unreasonably extended. So before you turn to the frisk, which I think you were doing, could you just comment on that quickly?
Sure. If I could just ask you to clarify the question, which part of that argument?
That the stop was unreasonably extended by the
Rodriguez issue.
By the search, yeah.
Yeah. A couple of responses on the Rodriguez issue. First of all, as we've articulated in our reply brief, we don't think this court should go there. The affirm on alternate grounds doctrine works best in a situation in which a party raised an issue, it was litigated, created a record, and then the district court, for whatever reason, doesn't address it. We have the opposite of that here. He didn't raise this Rodriguez claim below. We didn't have the chance to respond to it, and there's no record about it. And so if this court were to address the Rodriguez issue, you would necessarily be speculating. You'd be evaluating the constitutional justification for asking these questions when the officer was never given the chance to explain why he asked these questions. So we'd be conducting a constitutional analysis based on speculation. So for that reason, we just don't think the court should go there. But if you go there, to go to your question, Your Honor, there's some dispute in the circuits about how strictly to interpret Rodriguez. There's a Third Circuit case, the name is escaping me, that I just looked at a couple days ago, from just a few months ago, that addresses the different circuit opinions. Some circuits have looked at it very narrowly and said anything that deviates in any way from the stop's initial justification violates Rodriguez. The Sixth Circuit, in a case we did not cite, but the name of it is Collazo from 2016, says that you're still looking at it in terms of a reasonable time construct. The Vargas case, which we did discuss in a reply brief, seems to take what I think is really a third tack and seems to say as long as they would have been detained at that moment anyway, you don't have an unlawful detention problem. And so there's a lot of different ways to look at it. But whatever way you look at it, we don't think there's an unlawful detention here because the officer has a couple of different things that he's validly able to do at that moment. The first one is the one we've addressed in the reply brief. He's got to figure out who can drive the car away. So under the Vargas approach, which is, was she validly detained at that moment, there's no possibility that she could have left at that moment. And so she was going to have been detained at that moment. How can she complain that the detention was unlawfully prolonged? But the second thing is if you look at this whole scenario from his perspective, he's got a couple of different decisions he has to make at that moment. One, he's got to decide, am I going to arrest her for any of the number of reasons I can arrest her? Two, if I arrest her, am I going to try to impound her car? Then we get into a Sanders analysis. But there's some discretion under some officer policy. So he's got to decide, am I going to arrest her? If so, am I going to impound her car? And if the answer to those questions is no, what am I going to do about this lack of a license problem?
And he doesn't deal with that right away.
No, he doesn't.
He asks her questions about what she's up to and what's in her car and what might her passengers have on them. So it's a little ways into the recording before... It's actually quite a ways because then they find the gun. But before he gives her an opportunity to call someone who has a valid driver's license to come and pick up the car.
Well, up until minute 10, here's how I see the sequence here. Up until minute 9 and a half in the video, he runs the records check. He finds out that that nobody in the car has licenses and so forth. He then leaves the licenses in the dashboard. He goes out and he immediately sort of launches into this series of questions. What's in the car? They have that discussion for about a minute, and then that's the point at which he says, hey, go ahead, look at my car. So the Rodriguez issue here is that minute of questioning. You know, is he allowed to even sort of deviate and ask, do you have anything illegal in the car? And here's where we're coming from here. One, if you look at it sort of in the Vargas way and say, well, could she have left at that point? The answer is no. So there's no unlawful detention. But even if you look at Rodriguez more narrowly, here's what you have the officer trying to figure out. Am I going to arrest her? Am I going to try impounding her car? Am I going to insist on sticking around until somebody shows up? And Rodriguez doesn't really say that an officer has some sort of temporal limitation on how long he can ask questions while he's trying to figure out what to do with his discretionary authority. That's the problem here, I think, from defendant's argument. This officer is entitled to decide which of these three tracks he's going to take, arrest or no arrest, impound or no impound, stay or don't stay. And so when he says to her, hey, what's in your car, one way to look at this is to say he's just trying to figure out which of these three avenues he's going to take. That's permissible. But even if you don't think it's permissible, this is a good attenuation case. The attenuation doctrine for two of the prongs we think clearly go our way. The first is the intervening circumstance. There's this argument in the defendant's brief that an intervening circumstance can't happen during an unlawful detention. That's inconsistent with Streiff. Streiff, this exact thing happens. The state of Utah conceded in Streiff that they didn't have reasonable suspicion to stop the guy. During that unlawful stop, they find the warrant, and the Supreme Court thinks that the warrant, which was discovered during the unlawful detention, was enough. So that would be true here as well. So the real argument is whether her consent was valid. And Mendoza-Salgado from this court, we think, answers that question. Mendoza-Salgado involves an unlawful detention in a home, and yet this court held that the voluntary consent was enough to attenuate. Here we don't even have the home problem. It's on a street. So it's less of a Fourth Amendment concern. And we have the same construct, an offer of consent. And so even if you are troubled by the Rodriguez implications, I think the attenuation doctrine clearly saves it.
Okay. Her consent is created by the unlawful extension of the stop. The only reason she consented is because she wasn't given the opportunity to get somebody to come and get the car.
I'm not sure that I would go with you on the word created. That's the problem I'm having with your question. I mean, even if you assume that there's a Rodriguez violation, that puts you in the same place that the state of Utah was at the beginning of Streiff, which is you have an unlawful detention, and what next?
But the existence of the warrant was completely extraneous to anything that was going on in the search. So you couldn't say they had a warrant that was caused by the Fourth Amendment violation. Here you might have consent that was caused by the Fourth Amendment violation. I think that's the argument defendant is making.
I think that is the argument. And our answer to that would be Mendoza-Salgado. You have the same problem in Mendoza-Salgado. They enter a home. They detain nine people. This court says at the outset of the attenuation analysis that it's going to assume that was unlawful. And yet it then says that even though they're unlawfully detaining them, the fact that the wife then says, hey, go ahead and look around my house, you're not going to find anything, that breaks the chain. So that would answer your concern, Judge McHugh. You have the same construct here. Even if it's true that his minute of questioning violates Rodriguez, the fact that she then says to him, she initiates the search discussion, she says, go ahead and look in my car, you have the same answer that Mendoza-Salgado gets, which is the moment she gives an unprompted offer of consent, that attenuates. So,
turning to the frisk, it looks to me like the officer, in watching the video again, that one of the officers had made a decision to frisk him. At that point, he stood him up. The gun was observed. But why? It seems to me the critical moment in time was that decision by the officer to stand him up for the frisk.
Right.
What justifies, what's the reasonable suspicion that would justify a safety pat down at that point?
I would have two responses to that. The first would be an initial one, which, as we've articulated in the reply brief, we think the critical moment is when they begin the frisk, not when they decide to frisk. That seems to be the way the Supreme Court talks about it in Terry. It talks about a search for weapons, and so the string cite that we have of cases talking about, well, if you grab the guy and then he pulls away, you still get to look at what they discover. That goes to this point, that if in an objective Fourth Amendment inquiry, where we're assessing the reasonableness of the action itself, and the action is the search, that it's appropriate to look at everything up until the moment of the search, and the search doesn't begin until they touch him. But to go to the premise of your question, even if it's true, as you suggest, that the critical moment is the decision to search, we still have enough before that moment to justify it. Officer Watson says on page 130 of the record, this is in his testimony, that he saw the bulge, quote, somewhere in the area when he sat down and I had began to approach him. That happens before the command to stand up. So Officer Watson, at least, has already seen the bulge before he's ordered to stand up. And under Mims, the bulge plus the traffic stop alone is enough. That's the clear holding of Mims.
So large bulge in Mims, small bulge here, does that? How does that factor in?
I think it would be very difficult to say to officers on the scene who have to make these decisions on the side of the road, a large bulge can support a frisk, but a small one can't.
These days a lot of men carry cell phones in their front pocket.
And sure.
That wasn't true in Mims's era.
No, but in Mims's era they would have been carrying wallets and they would have been carrying keys and they would have been carrying other things. And Mims is very clear that officers are not required to, quote, take unnecessary risks. Officers shouldn't be in a position where they have to figure out what is that bulge really going to be, and am I really going to go through the business of this traffic stop wondering if that's a gun or if it's instead a cell phone? That's the thing they don't have to do.
Well, we had our case where they knew there was a knife in the pocket, and we still did not permit that.
That would be the House decision, right? But then House, Garcia, and Hughart both limit, if not outright overrule, that analysis. I see that I'm cutting into my rebuttal, but I do want to make one additional
point. I'll give you some rebuttal time.
To answer this question, I'll just take a minute of my rebuttal. We think that the bulge alone is enough under Mims, but even if the bulge alone is not enough, the bulge plus the search is. There's this point in the responsive brief that Fager says that a search alone doesn't automatically justify a frisk, but here's what Fager says about that. Quote, when an officer must turn his or her back to a defendant, we require little beyond this concern to support the officer's reasonable suspicion. That's page 386 of Fager.
You have two officers here, though.
We do, but then Fager says that the numbers game doesn't take this away. So if Fager says we require, quote, little beyond a search, so it seems like a search alone is almost automatic, but then a search plus the bulge, it's hard to imagine that this court could say that officers who are going to search a car and have also seen a bulge, which Watson very specifically says he did before Mr. Gruhl was ordered to stand up, that alone wouldn't be enough. And then when you throw in the other factors, there's at least reasonable suspicion.
Thank you. Thank you. Your time's up, Mr. Day. I'll give you a couple minutes rebuttal. Let's hear from the public defender. Ms. Obert, welcome.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. At core, this case is about a Rodriguez violation. Rather than completing the mission of the stop, the officer asked unrelated questions and took a detour, even though he lacked reasonable and articulable suspicion to do so.
But they couldn't leave at that point because there was no valid driver of the car. So the traffic stop couldn't be over because they couldn't go along their way until they had a valid driver.
The officer had a number of options at his disposal. He could have cited the parties, left the car parked in a public parking lot safely, and let them go on their way. He could have let them go on their way without citing them. He could have arrested the driver even and let the passengers go on their way. He could have done any of those things. What he couldn't have done was what he chose to do, which is to engage in a detour that is completely divorced from the mission of the stop without reasonable suspicion to do so.
What do you do with Mr. Tenney's argument that under Armijo versus Peterson, the officers didn't have to use the least restrictive option that available to them?
In terms of letting the passengers leave?
Right.
A couple of things, Your Honor. First, that doesn't address the Rodriguez violation, the detour.
Why not?
Questioning, because at that point, each of these individuals was still being detained by the police. And under Rodriguez, the officer had to move on with the mission of the traffic stop, the purpose of the traffic stop, in a timely manner. The officer's questioning, though, had nothing to do with the mission or purpose of the traffic stop. The officer wasn't saying, hey, let's get a driver for you, or I'm going to impound your car. The officer was saying, hey, let's make a deal. You tell me what is unlawful in the car and I won't arrest you.
Okay, can I ask you, so there's two aspects of it. One is the questioning of the driver, which is the predicate for your Rodriguez claim, but the driver is obviously not protesting anything. And then there's the detention of the seizure of Mr. Gourlay. Now, why does the whatever the officers did to the driver in prolonging her, why does that have a bearing on whether or not Mr. Gourlay was being detained any longer than he otherwise would? And I think that goes to the Mr. Tenney's argument under Vargas and these other cases that say that the passengers are going to be detained for the duration of the stop anyway.
And unlawful detention of the driver is similarly an unlawful detention of Mr. Gourlay. It's why he has standing even to challenge this case and why the government didn't dispute that standing. Because if he is being detained, his detention has to be based on constitutional permissible grounds, just like the driver's does. So a Rodriguez violation as to her is a Rodriguez violation as to him as well. He's being detained while the officer does this foray into unrelated inquiries, just like the driver is. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does, and I don't mean to occupy so much of your time, but to some extent, the anomaly that I see in weaving through this is that Mr. Gourlay, under this Rodriguez theory, is being detained longer than he otherwise would, in part maybe because of the officers, and in part because of what the driver did.
In terms of consenting?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because that's the whole reason that the stop is prolonged.
So the Rodriguez violation preceded the consent. There is at least a minute where the officer is talking about illegal things in the car, what are these folks with you have on them, before the driver ever consents. There are concerns, of course, as outlined in the brief, that the consent is a product of this
unlawful
detention.
Let's say we think the consent was consensual, not coerced. Does the attenuation doctrine apply?
No, Your Honor.
And why not?
The attenuation doctrine doesn't apply because of the Rodriguez violation, too. I mean, I know that...
Well, that's the whole point of the attenuation doctrine, is that we know we already have... We're assuming for this discussion that there is a Fourth Amendment violation. And so the question is whether consensual agreement to let them search her car created attenuation.
No, Your Honor. This is very much an issue akin to Wong Soon, to kind of the original case. In Wong Soon, the officers entered the home unlawfully and then very quickly thereafter obtained consent. And the court said, no, this isn't divorced enough from the taint of the unlawful entry. In this case, the consent was an exploitation of this detention. It was during the unlawful detention. So it's like Wong Soon, only worse. There is no attenuation or intervening circumstance sufficient to remove that taint. And if I may, with regard to Judge Bacharach's question about the driver's consent and how that really affects things here. At bottom line, the government is asking for a new rule. And they're claiming that they're only asking for a modest rule, which allows officers to detain passengers outside a car for the duration of the stop. But really what they're asking for is a broader rule. They're asking for a rule saying that the driver's consent is effective against the passengers and effective indefinitely. And they're asking for this rule even though it's something that they've not raised before and that they're now raising in favor of reversal.
Well, I don't mean to interrupt you. Well, I guess
no,
I do.
Please.
Sorry. But isn't it a little unfair to say that Mr. Tenney didn't raise that, even though he is, he's the appellant, because this Rodriguez theory was not in your motion to suppress?
The Rodriguez did show up in the motion to suppress, only it was focused on a later portion of the stop.
Right. Well,
but
true.
But Rodriguez definitely was raised, and I think that's important because it did put the government on notice, even below, that every step of the detention was at issue, and it's always the government's burden to prove that that is legitimate. So just the fact that Rodriguez was raised as an issue below, I think, is significant. But you're absolutely right in that the theory has changed somewhat here. With regard to the new rule, though, it's still significant because the government is relying on this as a grounds to reverse the district court, which does change the way that this court looks at it. The government's argument and briefing, legitimately so, makes it sound like they're used to winning. I'm used to losing, so I understand that. But the reality is it's reversed in this case. And if you follow the government's request for this new rule on consenting parties, it would give essentially consenting parties control over law enforcement authority over a third party.
But we do that already, right? If somebody gives consent to the search of a home, and all the members of the family who are in the home can be detained during the search. They can all either be put out to sit on a curb, they can be sat on a couch, something, and that's just the same thing, isn't it?
It's different because there is an aspect of Fourth Amendment law that is informed by common social interactions. In Georgia versus Randolph, in Florida versus Jardines, the Supreme Court talks about how the understanding of two people who live in the home, one who is saying, yes, you can come in, and the other standing behind saying, no, you can't, how that affects the Fourth Amendment community expectations and officer expectations. And one of the questions that we have to ask here is, what do you sign on for when you get into somebody else's car? Do you really sign on that they can consent to let an officer take apart their car bolt by bolt? The officer has no suspicion about you as a passenger, none at all.
Would Mr. Grulet,
and yet they can detain you,
have had to object? In your example of in the home, you have one person saying yes and one person saying no. But here we have the owner of the car saying yes and none of the passengers saying no. I don't want to sit here while you search this car.
Well, he didn't have authority to object to the search of the car. He did, of course, object to the search of himself, which I think is maybe one thing that underlies part of the police officer's approach here. He dared to tell them no, which, according to their own testimony, is something that hadn't happened before. And one of them said, even when people told him no, he would search them anyway. So he did object to what he could object to, which was the search of his body. Talking about social expectations, though, if that driver had withdrawn her consent at 20 seconds into that search, then the officer at that point would have had to let Mr. Garulet go, right? And if she had said, no, you can take apart my whole car right here in front of me, then under the government's theory, she is in control of the authority that this officer has over Mr. Garulet. That doesn't seem to fit the social interactions and expectations that a person has as a passenger in another's car.
Does it matter that none of them had a valid driver's license? So, the car's not going anywhere. And, we never get to this point. I had a case, 1983 case years ago, where the officer did let a passenger go in the process of arresting the driver, and the passenger left and staggered into the street and got run over by a car. It's a 1983 case. But, you know, there's a number of considerations that might go into whether you let a person on the street, and I think this was termed a high-crime area. I don't know if that's true or not, but do you release an individual on the street and, unarmed in theory in a high-crime area? Or I can see there's a lot of factors that might go into an officer's judgment there. And so, are we back to a reasonableness standard, or, you know, it's a bright line and Mr. Grulé is free to go?
The officer could have
withdrawn.
I'm sorry. The officer could have let him go. The officer could have arranged for rides. The officer could have offered him a ride if he was concerned, right. Although I don't believe there were any indications of drunkenness or fear for safety in that sense, where he would be stumbling into the street. It's the fact that they don't have driver's licenses is relevant to what may happen to the vehicle.
Let me ask you this. If we go through all the other issues and we get to the point where we think the consent was valid and the officer had a right to search the car, do you think officer vulnerability is a factor in whether the officer has to search the car turning his back to the passengers sitting behind him without having done a quick frisk?
The foundation for frisks remains Terry. There has to be a suspicion that somebody is armed and dangerous in order to conduct a frisk. That's at core what needs to happen. And without that, the officer can't conduct a frisk, even if they're there validly for a consent search. The district court in this case specifically found that there was no reason in the facts to believe that Mr. Grulé was dangerous at all. And the finding would have to be, or the reasonable suspicion would have to be, that he was armed and dangerous. That was lacking here, bulge or no bulge.
The district court also held that in applying Terry, you had to show that criminal activity was afoot. The district court went beyond just armed and dangerous. And that's standard has been expressly rejected by the Supreme Court for traffic stops. Did the district court err?
The district court's ultimate conclusions were correct, Your Honor. With regard to this case being a violation in that Mr. Grulé was detained far beyond what the purposes of the traffic stop were. At one point in the district court's opinion, I think it's in the record on, I think it's page 67, the court says something like, Mr. Grulé should have been let go as soon as the officer got out of his car and saw that he had no warrant for his arrest and there was no other suspicion for him at that point. That's a different way of saying this is a Rodriguez violation. As soon as the officer spent that 10 minutes in his car and realized he should have let him go. I see my
thank you, counsel.
Time
your time's expired. We appreciate thank the you. Argument. Please put 2 minutes on for Mr. Tenney.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just two brief points, one about the detention and one on the Rodriguez issue. On the detention, the dangers associated with the traffic stop come from the possibility that the search is going to produce incriminating evidence against someone involved and that person might have reason to fight. That doesn't go away depending on the justification for the search. That's true equally, whether it's a probable cause search or a consent search. And if you need an example of why this would be the case, of all the people on the scene, the one who knew about the contraband was the backseat passenger, Mr. Garul. So knowing what we now know, sort of in the 1,000-foot level, the one person in that car who had a reason to fight was him. And if you say to officers, look, in a consent search scenario, you have to let the passengers go, in a situation like Mr. Garul's, the person who would have reason to fight would be the person who would get to leave and circle around and fight. That can't be the rule, because it's going to put officers in a position in which, in a consent search, they're going to be watching their backs instead of searching, and it's going to create dangers. And the Fourth Amendment doesn't require them to create dangers. So our base rule is simply that. As long as they can search, they can detain people, and they can detain them until the justification for the search ends. On the Rodriguez attenuation, I think the Rodriguez issue is complicated in part because Rodriguez is complicated, and it's new, and there hasn't been a lot of circuit development on it. The cleanest way through it is probably the attenuation analysis. Counsel invoked Wong Sun. Here's what Mendoza-Salgado said about Wong Sun. This is page 1013 of the Mendoza-Salgado decision. Quote, "Our circuit does not believe that under Wong Sun or Brown, the government is required to show attenuation beyond a finding of voluntary, valid consent under Fourth Amendment standards." So again, this circuit, Mendoza-Salgado was really the case from our end about this. It holds that even if there is an unlawful detention, a valid consent can be the intervening event. And so here, for the reasons we've articulated, we think it is a valid consent. And even if you move to that third factor, what to do with Rodriguez is really complicated. It couldn't have been obvious or flagrant to these officers under the state of Rodriguez law, which is in flux, that they couldn't ask her these questions. Happy to answer any other questions. If not,
thank you, counsel. We appreciate it. Counsel are excused. The case will be submitted, and we will take a brief recess.